This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Kate Mildenhall, it's the tail end of school holidays. And you're back.
It is.
It's nice to see you in your little log cabin.
I know. I do feel it's odd to be back. I can't believe it's the end of school holidays already. I have had a lovely one.
Today is the football public holiday.
Grand final public holiday, indeed. I believe you still have a little bit of fun left in you, Catherine Collette.
We have. 3 days of jam-packed fun coming up. I'm leaving in a couple of hours for the long-awaited, much-anticipated in this household trip to Crowell Castle.
I am so excited. You know, one of the exciting things for you, consider when I think back to that conversation and some of the feedback that you got from our lovely listeners on Instagram in particular about their own visits to Crowell Castle, is that it's going to be a beautiful weekend weather-wise. So you're not going to have to worry about the cold dungeon-like conditions.
No, I think it's going to be really good. I am not a big planner of trips and itineraries, any of that sort of stuff, nor is Carney, which generally doesn't affect us too much because we do mainly beachside holidays. I have created a full jam-packed itinerary. I've printed copies for kids. I have booked restaurants. There's a schedule. It's an extravaganza. Like, it seriously is. It's going to be heaps of fun.
What do you believe the highlight will be of this jam-packed itinerary?
I think Crowell's going to be pretty good. A couple of people I've spoken to about Crowell Castle, and they've said that it's been upgraded in the past couple of years, and it's vastly improved on the experience if people went sort of even 3 or 4 years ago. There's a potion-making session that's meant to be fantastic. And
amazing.
There's jousting, I think, will be the highlights for Crowell. But there's even small things. Like, I've really thought about it. We're getting the buffet breakfast one day. There's that Cold Rock ice cream where they get to cut up all the bits and put it into the ice cream. We've decided to go to Sovereign Hill.
The kids are going to lose their mind.
I'm surprised at the affordability of it in some ways, because the entry to Crowell Castle, I think, for like a family of four, the kids are each bringing a friend, is maybe something like $140. But if you pay for the accommodation, and we have this weirdly cheap, potentially windowless room that is markedly cheaper than the other things on the website, I think the entry to Crowell Castle comes free. I actually think that the room is cheaper than the entry to the castle, which is troubling from the point of view of what this room is going to look like. There's only two very strategically taken photos of the room on the website. So that is pretty cool. And then Sovereign Hill, which I always had in my head was going to cost a fortune, is for a family of four, $129, but it's the same price for a family of six. How good's that?
That's great.
Yeah.
This is support for all those people
it's
who have many, many
children.
The
universe is endorsing this trip.
I want so many photographs of this trip.
Get onto the photographs.
Particularly the other non-strategic images of the room and all of you sorting yourselves
hilarious.
Out.
Tilly, like, talk about misconception. So the buffet breakfast, I think, for kids is like $15. Tilly was like, will it be like the buffet at Crown Casino? Bless.
Not quite, Tilly.
Similar.
This is the benefit, though, of also having kids who generally do beachside,
yes.
you know, very camping much. Or whatever holidays is that anything above and beyond, Etta, on our recent trip when we stayed in Big Fours and we stayed in cabins because we were just doing one night each. Like I'd already decided this is not a camper trailer
trip. Make it easy, yeah.
A cabin, just it blows her mind. Mm. Like the excitement of sheets and towels, yes, and the color coordination and the fact that drawers have all the things that you need. She was just completely and utterly blown away.
And yep, things in yep, packets. Tilly, so the bunk room has there's like a double bedroom or a queen bedroom, and then there's a bunk room with three bunk beds, so six beds in total. Like the debate about like top bunk, bottom bunk, how are we going to decide? Yeah, there's been a lot of joy.
I did actually have to take the top bunk at one point.
Oh, God.
Yeah, because obviously we were one child down when I left, not because of anything terrible. She just had basketball things to do. So mum and dad obviously got the, you know, queen room or the master room, and that was always the idea that I would share with the kids. But Etta didn't want the top bunk. It was terrifying up there. Like I haven't slept
right, in these all bunk want the top bunk
as an adult. And yeah, as an adult, it's quite high and it's complicated to get a whole yes, adult body up there. Like as a kid, you kind of just run and launch.
Yes.
And, you know, tangle your way up and like a little monkey. But it's, no.
It's kind of potato potato. Like the top bunk is about falling out, but the bottom bunk is about being crushed.
Yes.
So like also, sort yeah, of a no-win situation.
Yeah. I mean, I don't recommend bunks, but also fine. Very serviceable. Very, very easy and serviceable.
This room would not fit even if you took all the mattresses down and put them on the floor. There would not be, I suspect there would not be enough space on the floor to.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a tight, the limited vantage on the floor.
Obviously, at the end of your Cryo Castle trip, when we next catch up, we will have to do the breakdown of, as we said at the start, the Bali with 29 people versus Cryo Castle yes, with six. I'd just say what you're aiming for, touch wood, is that no one ends up in hospital, you know, or has a heart attack at the end, which is what one of my dear friends did after ours. So, terrible. You know, let's just, he's fine, by the way, he's fine. But you know, aim for that.
This is a low threshold. I have seen photos of like medieval stocks. That'll be fun.
Ooh,
you know, with the hands stuck yes, in the wood and throw tomatoes. Obviously,
yes,
throw tomatoes. But yeah,
on jousting, because it's actually we've been watching One Piece. Have you watched One Piece?
No.
Oh, okay, very cool. It's on Netflix. It is violent in a sword fighty medieval kind of way. It's pirates. It's based on a Japanese manga that I had no idea about, but the Netflix production is superb, like big budget, beautifully done. Boy Luffy, who wants to be king of the pirates, and his ragtag gang of, you know, extremely cool pirate people. So Etta has got into the idea that she wants to be a sword fighter now. Yeah. So I'm like, do I look
like fencing?
Fencing classes? Yeah. Well, I did say you can't just start. She said, no, I don't want a little one like fencing. I want a big sword. I said, you don't just get to start with a big sword, mate. You have to, you know, I don't think you'll ever get a sword.
My high school, they offered fencing.
Really?
Which is pretty random.
Yeah. Kelly Gardner does it. Or maybe I'll ask Kel. She has like fencing things, sorty jousting things up on her wall in her house. So maybe I'll ask her for her recommendation. But also I highly recommend One Piece as a Netflix series. One. Yeah.
Write that down. For families.
For families, yeah. Very fun. Like kind of wholesome in a people getting killed by swords kind of a way. Good messaging about it and beautifully done and kind of funny.
Very hard to find family viewing, I think, that's legit entertaining for the family.
Yeah. I give that the thumbs up. How did your time with Carnie away go? How has the rest of the school holidays panned out for you?
We went to, it's pretty fun actually. Carnie went on his fishing trip.
Did he catch many fish?
No, it was a disaster.
Oh,
they
God.
Have completely refined the process. So the way they did it the first time was to take like 2 weeks off work and book in the charters. But the thing with fishing is it's all weather dependent. Mm-hmm. So now they have a new process that is wait for the weather and then just quickly book and fly in, fly out. Like stay for two nights at the airport hotel. Go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because when you say it was a disaster, no fish, like were there any fish?
Legitimately no fish. And they are, I think there was a point at which I think they both just went to bed at like midday. Like they were both so like dejected about the whole thing. The weather was terrible, which so boats weren't allowed to go out into the ocean. The one day that the boats, the weather was favourable, the boat that they were on, the engine broke down.
Oh,
as they were, like, it was really, really crushing. Having said that, they were in Queensland with no kids, and so they had sort of a sense of humour about it once they had got through the crushing of their spirit. But I don't think they caught any. Oh, they went to a barramundi farm, and I was like, "Is a barramundi? Is that like trout fishing?" And he said it's a little bit better than trout fishing because barramundi put up more of a fight, but dire, very dire.
Wow. Will that make it into the? Is it acceptable for Carney for that to make it into your newsletter in a little series? Because I feel like that will be quite funny.
Could be. Need some content. Yeah, that's perfect. But he, I was confused when you were asking about that because we also just bought a secondhand car that Carney had searched for many, many months and finally found this car that he wanted, which is not necessarily a particularly good car. It's actually the same car that we already have. Like,
why did he want this particular one?
He just really likes Ford Territories. They don't make them anymore. And he wanted one that had been extremely well looked after. So he ended up finding one a couple of hours away from Wagga. Wagga's quite far. That's nearly a five-hour drive from Melbourne if you straight drive. So he drove up and back in one day, and then he had to catch – then we decided to buy the car, so he had to catch a bus. He had to catch a train to Wagga and then a bus to this remote location. But he befriended – this is something that I would never do, potentially you would do. He so befriended this guy that was selling the car – that first the guy was like, why don't you stay the night? Carney was like, oh no, I've already booked accommodation. This is when he had gone to pick up the car because it was, you know, pretty epic trip. He ended up staying there for like 6 hours. They did a exercise workout together. The guy made him dinner. Like, he's got a firm friend now in the
wow.
Yeah.
That's almost the start of a crime setup.
Well, it sort of is. Carney was like, yeah, there were moments that it was weird, but you just had to let it go and just be sort of okay with it. The weirdness of hanging out with the person you're buying the car off. Anyway.
Can I say something? Can I segue gently there into the delight of meeting people? Because the week or however long it was that I did with Edda and Mum and Dad doing book things and, you know, up and around the coast and into some back blocks, you know, like Boorua is maybe 2 hours south of Canberra, 40 minutes up from Yass, kind of in that little pocket. The beauty of doing regional town events and visits is that basically you end up besties with everyone at the end of the...
It's kind of lovely.
It's so lovely. And just that reminded me because one of the absolutely delightful humans that I met is a guy, a farmer called David Marsh, who lives just outside of Boorua. Beautiful man, beautiful story. He does regenerative farming and he's writing a book. Just it was just a delight to meet him and his wife and hear his story. And like before we left the next morning and we were on talking about itineraries, like we were on our schedule. There was a lot to get through and a lot of kilometres to do. And, you know, we had to be in places at certain times. But he'd sent through an email, you know, inviting me and the family out to visit his farm and, you know, stop past for morning tea. And we couldn't fit it in on that day. But I absolutely very much hope to go back to Boorua and the lovely Jeremy.
Gorgeous generosity. Like, and I do think the more you do it, the more open to it
yes.
you become, or it kind of feeds on itself. Like, it's easy to be like, oh, I would, you know, I'm not embracing that currently, yes. But once like a little door, it's like a little door opens, yes. And then it just keeps getting, yes. Wider and wider and wider, and you sort of become your best,
well,
self.
You're right, and it stops being odd. It stops being, yes, that thing where you're, exactly, like, oh, that's definitely the start of a thriller,
yes,
because you're like, oh, actually, lots of people out here are just wonderfully generous and legitimately want you to come and,
yeah,
see the house or
it's
meet
a real
the family.
Moment of observing the good of humanity in some ways.
Yeah, like, absolutely. It's nice. Absolutely.
Very real. Oh, how lovely.
How lovely. Tell me things. Who are you talking to this week for our featured book?
This week I'm talking to Molly Schmidt about her book Salt River Road. This episode, the featured book, is brought to you by Fremantle Press, and we're talking to writer and journalist Molly Schmidt. Molly Schmidt is from the coastal town of Albany in Western Australia. She's passionate about producing stories that are inclusive of all members of her community. Her first novel, Salt River Road, was written as part of her honours thesis under Miles Franklin Award winner Kim Scott, who has also been on this show, and novelist Brett Darcy. As part of the writing process, Molly collaborated with Noongar elders to produce a work that actively pursues reconciliation. She's a radio producer and journalist for the ABC, where her passion for storytelling is put to good use. Welcome, Molly, to the First Time Podcast.
Hi, thank you so much.
Massive congratulations on the book, to begin with. It is such an exciting work. It's experimental with form, but I think also it has such a clear idea of what it sets out to do, and it really achieves that. So well done.
Oh, thank you. That's a huge compliment.
We're going to start by telling listeners what Salt River Road is about. Can you give us the elevator pitch?
Yeah, sure. So Salt River Road is a coming-of-age story. It's set in the late 70s between the coast and the paddocks of regional WA, and it tracks the story of teenage siblings Rose and Frank Tetley, who are coming to terms with losing their mum to cancer, and it's told from their parallel perspectives. These two are nearly twins. They're born a year apart on exactly the same day, but their experience is really different with how they respond to the loss. Their sheep farm is going to ruins around them, as their other siblings and their dad are also not coping. We learn about Rose and Frank's individual experiences through poetry as well as prose. So a bit unique in that sense. A lot of the more emotional inner workings of these two are told through the poems, and you see how Rose really takes on the responsibility of her family while Frank goes off the rails and steals and drinks his way through his grief. I suppose in among that, there's this parallel narrative that really celebrates the traditional custodians of the land that the book is set upon, and that's the Menang and Goreng Noongar people. And there's two really important characters, two elders, Uncle Herbert and Auntie Patsy, who become almost like grandfather figures and guides in a way for Rose and Frank. Mm-hmm. They first meet Rose. She's marching along the highway, kind of trying to escape her grief, and they pick Rose up and take her home. And, yeah, it sort of suddenly brings up this unresolved conflict between the families that has been left untouched for a really long time. And, yeah, I guess the reader starts to learn that it's not only the Tetleys who have broken hearts that need to be healed throughout the book.
Such a lovely story. It says, I just said in your bio, that you worked really closely with Noongar elders on the book. What did that look like?
So that looked like I had originally written a book that, you know, is set in Albany, where there are, you know, very important traditional custodians living and still very connected to that land today. And originally I hadn't written any Indigenous characters into the book because I didn't know how, and I didn't want to get it wrong. And it felt sensitive, you know. So I went back to uni, as you said, supervised by Kim Scott, which was so lucky, really. And he connected me because he's also connected to the families in that area. he connected me with five elders from the Great Southern region and their families. And basically over 2 years, I was driving up and down. It's about a five-hour drive from Albany to Perth, driving up and down and just meeting with these elders and talking to them about, you know, I've written this book and it's set on your country and I want to include Noongar characters. If that's okay, what do you think? How should I do it? And so it was very collaborative because if they had said, we'd prefer that you didn't, I wasn't going to because it was very much, you know, wanting to hear from them. But in this particular case, they really wanted a local book to represent their people. And so, yeah, back and forth, I developed these characters of Patsy and Herbert, and I would share the scenes with the elders that I was working with and we'd work out together the scope of what was okay to include and not include and how they were happy with these characters being conveyed. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was really collaborative and such an honour to work with them.
You can really see what an impact it's had in terms of story, but I wondered also what impact that experience had on you.
Oh, it was enormous. I'm still close with some of the elders now. You know, I feel really lucky. A few of the elders have become like the grandfather figures that I wrote for Rose and Frank for me. And that, you know, that was not something that I guess expected or, you know, it to me it's a huge privilege. But they've really let me into their lives. You know, one of the elders, Uncle Lester, is just such an important person in my life now. And he actually made me the auntie of his grandson, which is a huge cultural honor. I suppose for me it's fully changed my path as well. Like I'm looking at the moment of how I can keep working with these elders and giving back to them. They've helped me hugely. I want to see if I can help them with their storytelling in any way. It's been enormous for me.
God, I'm getting like goosebumps. It's such a lovely kind of sense of circularity to it or something. I'm interested in where the writing of the book began. When did you know that this was a story that you wanted to write and how did you begin?
That's funny. Do you remember Lever Arch files? Does anyone use them anymore?
I remember them. They're the sort of thing that are in the recycling cupboard at my work.
Yeah.
That just abandoned hundreds of them.
Absolutely. So the very first drafts are on the like pre-ruled margins lined paper. You know, when it would have the pre-ruled red margin in biro pen, hand printed.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so I was a teenager when I first met Rose and Frank. I remember the first time I wrote their names down and I found this piece of paper the other day moving house, which was such a nice thing to actually hold. But I was driving in the back of the car. I wasn't old enough to drive yet, between Albany and Perth, and we drove through Tenterden, which is the really little farming community that I ended up setting where Rose and Frank live. And I was processing my own loss of losing my dad to cancer. I was 10 when I lost Dad.
Wow.
I hadn't worked through that grief, I suppose. And it was my own trauma and my own story that I was kind of exploring through this separate, you know, the separate lens of exploring it in fiction with Rose and Frank. And they were the siblings that I didn't have to sort of explore it with.
Mm.
And, yeah, it was honestly at the beginning very much just a kid exploring what they'd been through. But the characters really stuck with me and they became, you know, friends that I kept speaking to through paper and pen. And, yeah, they wouldn't leave me alone basically until it was like 10 years later that the actual book became clearer to me and I picked them up again.
And so what did that phase of writing look like? People talk, for example, about being pantsers and plotters. Did you start to plan things out or did it continue to be exploratory at that stage?
I think it was very exploratory. I feel like I always get a bit of imposter syndrome when I hear writers, you know, plan their narrative, and I never did any of that. I think because these were characters that I'd had kind of with me for such a long time that to me, it felt bigger than me. They existed. They were real to me. I couldn't work out what they were going to do. So I would just sit down and write, and they would sort of show me. I don't know. That sounds so cliche, but I never really had a clear narrative plot at all until literally last year, when I was trying to finish the draft to submit it for the Hungerford Award. And I had to finish it. So that was the first time that I kind of actually had to look at the time frames. And because I'd come back and forth to the story so many times over the years as well, there was an awful lot of tidying up and working out the timeline to do in hindsight. But yeah, it was always very sporadic until then, really.
You mentioned the Hungerford Award. That's the award you ended up winning.
Yeah, which was really surreal. And I, you mentioned before kind of the full circle feeling with it. The Hungerford was really similar. There were so many synchronicities where I had just moved back for a short period to Albany and for work. So I was actually in the place that I had started writing the book and where it was set. And I was, you know, in the middle of unpacking. There were boxes everywhere. It was complete chaos when I realized that the Hungerford date, like the closing date, was approaching. And I really wasn't sure, you know, if I could do it. I think because I had spent so long writing the book, it felt impossible that it could be done in a short time frame. But yeah, I did. I submitted it and didn't expect it to even be long-listed, let alone shortlisted, let alone get there. So it was really mind-blowing. And Frio Press was always where I wanted it to land. So that was a whole other layer of dream come true.
And how, where were you when you found out that you had won?
It was funny, actually. I was about to do, really lucky, had was doing a writing fellowship up in the hills in Perth when I found out. Well, no, sorry, I've messed that up. I found out I won actually at the Hungerford Award night. Should I tell you about that?
Oh, wow, yes.
Yeah, we didn't know. Yeah.
Oh, I always think people go in and they know, like, everybody knows who won, but no, it was truly a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. So the moment that I found out I won was literally on stage at the Fremantle Arts Centre. I was not expecting it at all. And I kept saying to people that I was really excited to have been shortlisted. And, you know, I had friends and family that have been, you know, following along from home while I've written this book for such a long time that were coming and really excited. And I kept saying to them, please, can you just celebrate that I've been shortlisted? I don't want you to expect me to win. For me, this is the achievement and I'm happy. And I really thought that was it. And so it was just a crazy feeling because I did. I had a lot of friends and family there and they were screaming and, you know, shouting when they said my name. and I don't remember the moment of saying the thank you speech because I was so shocked. I've watched it back, but I literally don't. I have no recollection of that.
Had you prepared any talking points or you just?
They told us that we should. Okay. And I'm a very anxious planner sort of person. So I had, but I'd done it literally just because, you know, I was like, they've told us we should, so I must do that, but I won't need it. I don't think I even used the notes. I was so shocked. But yeah, it was a huge mind-blowing moment that hasn't really stopped being mind-blowing at all.
Oh, you need those moments. Now, Salt River Road has a beautiful cover. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of the cover?
Yeah, so the cover is by a Noongar artist from Albany, Glenda Williams. And I met her through Uncle Lester, one of the elders that I worked with at a women's painting circle in Albany, and I remember I saw her painting. It's quite small. It's actually not really much bigger than the cover.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And she was working on it and I was just really struck by it. And I remember I asked her then if I could take a photo of it because I really liked it. And that I, you know, was writing a book and maybe one day there'd be a cover and maybe one day it could be her painting. But it was all very, you know, maybe one day.
Yeah.
And I sent it on to Frio Press and again didn't expect anything of it. That seems to be the story for me. I haven't expected any of this at all. but it landed. They really liked it. And we worked with Glenda. And yeah, it was adapted, you know, to fit the dimensions of the cover. But it is that painting that became the cover.
Mm.
And it's really special, actually, because the painting is of kwandong, so a native fruit. And they actually grow on Salt River Road, which I didn't know. But
how lovely is that? Molly, we have a lot of writers that listen to this show. Can you tell us what is either the best or the worst writing advice you've ever received?
Oh, best or worst? I don't know about worst. Best, I would say, to let yourself dream. I think that's been a big part of it for me, just letting, I don't know, I feel like it's a world that's very easy to feel people don't understand and it's isolating and, you know, it's never going to go anywhere. But I think if you let yourself dream, it's actually so exciting. And I did have one of my lecturers and supervisor, Brett Darcy, who I worked really closely with too, would encourage me to make connections along the way. And that's been really valuable too, just working with the other writers around me and learning from them and asking questions. And yeah.
That is great advice. It can be a really lonely pursuit.
Yeah.
Final question. Can you recommend another book by a debut author? It can be from any genre, from any place.
I can. So I had the pleasure of watching Georgia Tree go through her publishing journey a few months ago. So she's also a Fremantle Press author. Her book Old Boy came out in July. And it's a nonfiction, but reads like a thriller novel. It's amazing. It's set in Perth in the 80s. So there were some parallels, I guess, with how we'd both written about a real place in the past as well that we'd called home. But Georgia's book is about her dad's struggle with addiction and overcoming that. And it looks at the 80s heroin epidemic in Perth. But it's a really interesting, untold part of that, I guess, of our history. And it's from her dad's perspective. So Georgia sat down with her dad and interviewed him over a really long time and then, yeah, wrote, kind of got in his brain and wrote the story from his perspective. And it's, yeah, it's amazing. I loved it. I stayed up so late and just read it all at once. And, yeah, couldn't recommend it more.
Well, that's a great recommendation. Thank you, Molly, for being on the show. It's going to be a book bonanza by the sounds of it in this week's episode. What's your first book? You can start.
My first book, I'm going to start with the last one that I read. We fitted in a couple of days at the beach, just the four of us, at Walkerville. Have you camped at Walkerville?
Ace. It's got such a lovely little like pocket to do a ocean swim in. Yes, it's gorgeous.
It was utterly glorious. And also, I hadn't done all my research. It was a last minute kind of thing. We could all get away. And I didn't pack. I didn't realize you could do a fire bucket there. So we didn't have that gear. But they have these extraordinary handmade ex-Weber kind of buckets on the top of old lawnmowers.
Oh.
So that you can wheel it down to your campsite and then you just hire it for however long you're there and you get your wood and then you can kind of just wheel it into position.
How awesome is that?
So, so cool. I was like, I sent it to all our camping friends. I was like, I have never seen this before. We need one
of
these when we
can.
That was very cool. But it did mean that among other things, among swims and adventures and all the things, I did get some reading done. So what I did read is Charlotte's new book, Charlotte Ward's new book, Stoneyard Devotional. And it's
extraordinary. Can you send it to me? I don't have
ordinary.
A copy.
I can. Well, I'm actually doing an event with Charlotte for her Melbourne event for readings at Cinema Nova on October 11. There are still some tickets left if people want to get along.
I'm putting it in my diary right now.
So the premise of Stoneyard Devotional is that a woman who we don't know a lot about her situation, we kind of get the impression that she's worked in environmental kind of activism stuff, arrives at this, I don't know if you can call it a monastery, a religious order where there are nuns, and she stays there the first time just as a, you know, a guest. And it's this kind of extraordinary, it's like in diary form, riffing on the nature of finding peace and meaning and solitude at the same time as these very, you know, the way Charlotte writes is so beautiful, these kind of specific and detailed accounts of both what the nuns are doing, and the kind of story that overarches at the back is that a woman who has previously been a nun in this order died overseas, and her bones are being repatriated to this property. So that's kind of the backstory that goes along. It's a beautiful kind of reflection on these very particular moments from the character's past and what she's doing there. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder if this is partly the age that I am at, that reading it, it had that kind of internal nature of some of the, you know, loosely banded together sad girl novel kind of, you know, novels, in terms of that kind of, internal thinking over and over the events of one's life and what they have meant. Kind of. Yeah, rumination. Yeah, that's a good word. But to me, it felt pushed into the kinds of questions about living well and dying and thinking about your past that maybe I'm at. And I was like, oh, maybe this is just a shift in terms of what I want to read. I loved it so very much, and I have so many questions to ask Charlotte about it. It does feel very strangely, when you look at all her work together, it's got some real vibes from Natural Way of Things just because of the setting, this kind of remote regional property in New South Wales, that dryness, that kind of women living together. So it'll be really interesting to talk to her about some of those key kind of moments of heat for her and how they come up.
When you put it like that, you really can see the themes that she serves, can't you? Like, because the Weekend is, you know, very different book but has similar properties.
But as a kind of a, you know, I suppose it's nuns in this one property, in this kind of, you know, slow and quiet in a way backstory, but compulsively readable. Like that plot of what was going to happen to the bones and what's happening to her was absolutely enough for me to not want to put it down. So that is Stony Eyed Devotional from Charlotte Wood. Can't wait to hear what other people think about it. Very, very good. And I'll do one more while I'm at it. Oh, on another. So before I went away, I read Bryony Doyle's Why We Are Here. Have you heard about this?
I have seen that, but I don't know anything about it.
So Bryony Doyle is, I said on Instagram, and I maintain this, one of the very smartest people I know. I met her years ago at my very first festival. She was enormously kind to me in that infamous Byron Festival where I felt very green, beautifully kind. And we had a long walk where it first became apparent to me how incredibly, incredibly smart she is and well-read. I've loved her other books. I haven't read all of them, but she tends to do this kind of, you know, science fiction, climate fiction-based kind of story. Echolalia, the last one, which I haven't read, I think was on the Miles long list or short list. This one, Why We Are Here, she has described, I think, on The Garret as autofiction. So the character in it, BB, has moved to Sydney during the pandemic, having lost both her father and her partner. And she's moved there with her dog in this kind of house on the edge of the ocean. And it's her story over this time. It is absolutely about grief. And this is Bryony's recent experience. And I definitely had that sense of it as I was reading, and I knew that backstory. But it's also funny, and it is really about the love between her and this dog in a way, and the reflection on the love for her partner and her dad at the same time, but also just very funny stuff about her interactions with the locals. She becomes a kind of a dog trainer to some of these wealthy people she lives around. There's a golf, you know, golf course that she lives nearby. There's some very funny interactions with golfers. It's just a very, again, read it very quickly, She's a beautiful writer. It's a book that makes you think. I really loved it. And I think particularly, I don't have a dog, but I think for people who are lovers of dogs, this is a very beautiful book. And also for people the same way that I recommend Joan Didion, A Year of Magical Thinking, to people who are experiencing grief at a later time, not in the actual moment, but for people who want to read about or think about or ponder grief, particularly for a partner, very, very beautiful book, Why We Are Here, Bryony Doyle. That's two for me. I have more. Go to you.
That combination of sad and funny is I don't know why is that so good? It's heartfelt but uplifting in moments.
Yeah. And kind of spinning something out of the earnestness and relief, I think, for the reader as well.
Yeah.
People who do it well do it so well. Okay, tell me, what have you been reading?
Okay, I have to mention Wifedom by Anna Funda. Have you read this one?
I have not read it yet.
I imagine you've seen it everywhere.
Everywhere.
It is such an interesting book. So it's about Eileen O'Shaughnessy, who was George Orwell's first wife. First wife because, though you will read the book hoping she ends up divorcing him, she actually died in her early 40s. Basically, it is a biography in the sense that it looks at her life and at the really massive impact she had on George Orwell's writing. So Orwell obviously wrote 1984 and Animal Farm are the big books of his that we would remember. She's his sounding board. She also is kind of his editor in many ways. And I think that appears to be the source of he's not that nice. You cannot kind of come out of this book being a huge fan of George Orwell. But so she kind of works as an editor with him. That appears to be like the basis of their kind of love relationship is she really sees the artist in him. And in the case of particularly Animal Farm, she's like critically involved in the planning of the book to the point that he acknowledges not publicly that, you know, he really couldn't have written it without her. There's, you know, they talked about it every day and came up with, you know, this is how this will work and this is how that will work. So really fundamental to Orwell's writing. So that is interesting in and of itself. But what Funda does is she kind of looks at the way in which Eileen O'Shaughnessy has been written out of history. Mm. And so she goes to primary and secondary sources and she looks at what Eileen was doing at a point in time. And then she looks at how Orwell, who is, say, also present, so an example would be the Spanish War, he's fighting, Eileen's working for someone high up administratively and is working in a really risky sort of space herself. So she'll look at accounts of what Eileen's doing, then accounts that Orwell writes and that appear in his biographies, and look at the way that he just tweaks things and never acknowledges that she's there. So there'll be like an example would be during the Spanish War, they need to leave Spain. Eileen goes and gets visas for a group of them at great personal risk. It takes her days. It's the kind of thing if she's discovered who she is, you know, she would be killed sort of thing. So you have this instance of great bravery. In Orwell's essays and writing, he'll say something like, a visa was procured. You know, like it just is, and there are so many instances of the way in which he just glosses or tweaks. I mean, the kind of the worst part of it is that she's the one that does all his typing. Mm. So she would receive these essays from him handwritten and types them out and has to see as well the way in which he kind of omits her. So that is really fascinating. You also see how that act is perpetuated by his biographers. And the way in which you will have multiple instances of really inappropriate behaviour from Orwell, things like attempted rape, like bad sort of stuff, and how they just kind of gloss it over and the language. So they have sort of some French word for, you know, sex or you know, that you just this constant sanitizing of who he is. And so you both have this sort of story of a really interesting woman, but it's a critique of patriarchy as well. It's just a really very, very readable as well book, but completely fascinating and structurally just not something I've ever really seen.
And how is, I've been interested the whole time, and yes, I haven't picked it up and looked at it yet, in terms of Funda's presence in the book. How do you hear her voice? Because it's different. I'm thinking like in Stasiland, it's very forward. You know, she's absolutely there. What is it like in this book?
That's actually a really good question because she's in this book. She is in it as well, and she sort of flicks between. She will have in sections that are kind of from Eileen's point of view. She relies a lot on letters that Eileen has written, and whenever the words from letters appear, it's italicized, and then she's sort of fictionalized around that. So what she might be looking at and what she might be wearing, this kind of thing. But she also has sections where Funda is in the present day, sort of thinking about this, and she talks to how she became interested in it. She does talk to the impact of patriarchy, the way that this appears in the present day, and that kind of echo of stuff that you can say everything has changed, but in fact everything has not changed. There is a little bit of that. That's probably less where it shines in some ways, but she does have these sections that are within the present day where she reflects on Eileen, and that stuff's really interesting as well.
It's just interesting, a really cool book to also see in a way how, you know, how much it's exploded. Like, it's been the top selling book for however many months or whatever, not checking because I know that, you know, it came out a month before mine, so I've seen it everywhere. But also in that history of and trajectory of more fictionalized accounts of the wife of or the so-and-so's wife, you know, that have been very popular over the last little while in terms of bringing to light the, you know, wives behind the more famous husbands.
I think it is in that ilk, just this real, and she does it in such a way that it's so, so readable, the way that she really takes the time to say, this is what is happening and this is how Orwell has portrayed it. Like, you cannot, as I said, you can't like the guy after this book. And there's this real layer of irony in that he is a person who has looked very closely at power dynamics within society, but this power dynamic between men and women and the way that he benefits from, really, I mean, she is in servitude to him in many ways. And that is what allows him to be so prolific and to think and to write and all those kinds.
It's partly too, isn't it, that the primary accounts, I remember when I became really super obsessed with Paul Klee, you know, whose work I used in part for The Hummingbird Effect. And over the time that I was away, when I got really obsessed with him, I listened to a podcast that was letters between him and his wife, Lily Klee. And, you know, I'd kind of already fallen for the artist, him as an artist and his work, but I got so pissed off with him in listening to these letters back and forth, because it's that same, you know, she's at home looking after the children and working, and he's off working out colour in the desert in Africa, you know, like, and you just kind of go, oh, good for you, mate, you know, like, are you having your kind of artistic moment while your wife's at home looking after the kids and earning the money? It can't help but colour your reading of it does. The it, artist.
It absolutely does. And Funda comes at it, I think the start for her interest in him is that she has read lots of his biographies and is really kind of taken with him and the man that he was. So that in itself is fascinating, because she's a fan of his, but of his work.
Okay. Not of him. Adding. Must read.
Okay, second book for me is a middle grade junior fiction. It's Queenie in Seven Moves by Zani Louise. Have you read this one?
No, I haven't yet.
It's super cute. So it's about Queenie, who maybe upper primary, I think, lives with her mum. The house that they're renting gets sold. So it's sort of set recent-ish. I don't know that they talk to COVID within it, but pretty recent. And so Queenie in Seven Moves is the moves that they have to do to find a new home. They can't get a rental. So they end up, you know, living in this person's house and living in a caravan and living in all that sort of stuff. I think what's interesting about it is that in the acknowledgements, Zani talks about where the concept came from. And so basically she was living with her family in Byron Bay in 2019. When the pandemic happened, the property they were living in was sold, and so they started looking for rentals. And as we know, particularly in the North of Australia or along coastal areas, there were no rentals. Mm-hmm. And so her and her family lived out of suitcases. So she's sort of had this experience of moving to sheds and one-bedroom flats and all the rest of it. It's sweet and it's lighthearted and it's all of those things. You can completely just read it as a story, but it's also got this sort of frighteningly accurate, real element. And I think she does that so well. It's so hard writing kids' stuff that grapples with an issue without knocking you over the head and kind of beating it into you. Good one. Highly recommend.
Excellent. And Zani is, of course, the incredible human being who did that huge auction and rebuilding stuff after the Lismore floods. Like, I just think top-notch human. I'm looking forward to reading that. I've got a debut that I want to mention, and this is in part because one of the events that I did while I was coming down the coast was with Cal Woods, who is the debut author of a new book called After the Forest. I'm just checking that that's right. Yes, After the Forest. So fantasy. I read it really quickly. It's set in 1650 in the Black Forest. The character that we're following is Greta. We work out pretty quickly that this is kind of a retelling or a backtelling in some sense of the fairy tale Hansel and Gretel, but it's also got other fairy tales woven in there. When I talked to Kel, I found out that she has been mentored for some time by Kate Forsyth, and same kind of vibe in terms of really digging into the nature of fairy tale stories and also that darkness in them as well. Very clever, very readable. When I was messaging Kel when I finished, I think I used the words sizzling hot bear romance, which, you know, you'll have to get to the end to work out that part. But if you are into possible bear romances, this is one for you. Stuff about patriarchy, stuff about the burning of witches, just a very, very well done, very accomplished, I think, for a debut. I think it has sold internationally. It's coming out this week. And she was also just the most delightful human to talk to, one of those people who you meet and you feel like you have known them for a very long time. A great, scary, dark, twisty fairy tale. So I highly recommend that.
Survivor, the Alone series, the TV series where they're in the woods. We've started watching some of the American ones. I'm obsessed with bears. Bears are like, I did see on Twitter where they had a bear, a crocodile, and was it a hippo? And it was like, which would you pick to try and fight?
Whoa.
Bears are full on. Like, bears they can run fast, they can climb things, they can smell food from really far away. Yeah.
There's also, I'm just trying to search it up and now I can't find it at all. I went through a phase of reading books that had bears in them, adult books that had bears in them. I cannot for the life of me remember this particular one, but I will find it and recommend it to you because it's very good. Yeah, bears. It's like the lion and the shark thing, right?
Well, they have
they can eat us.
Yeah, that's right. They can, in areas, maybe it's Canada, you're not allowed to lock your cars. In case a bear comes, people need to be able to hide in the car. Like, a stranger needs to be able to get into your car. Like that.
Bears. Wow.
Yeah.
That is one of those details that you're kind of glad you know, but that would make me rethink going to Canada. I think my greatest fear is being eaten by an animal. Is that all of our greatest fear, though? Is that just a natural kind of thing?
That does not even register on my radar.
Sharks when you're swimming?
I just don't think that's how I'm going to go.
Yeah, nice.
Like, sometimes you get a bit wigged out, but mostly I'm in the bay too.
Yeah, good point, good point. That went deep very quickly, didn't it? I want to just mention one other book which I read and I get the opportunity to talk to the author, Anna Kate Blair's debut, The Modern, which I think from looking on Instagram, you heard her read recently.
Yeah. So I think we've mentioned this before. I don't think it's a secret. Graham Simpson and Anne Boost are both Melbourne-based authors, and they periodically host an event I think it's roughly twice a year. It's for authors of adult fiction novels. And it's really cool. It has a start time and a finish time. So it might be on a Thursday night. Probably don't need to be saying all this, but anyway, it starts at 6. It finishes at 8.
Does it actually finish on time?
It does. Sometimes Graham, I've been in Graham said, you can stay till 8:15. And then it's like everyone out. I love that. I could not love that more.
Yes. Love it.
They have like this amazing apartment sort of thing in, it's located in an old church. Maybe I don't need to say that as well. But it has a library bar in it. And then it has like a big area where you can kind of stand around and chat to people, and lots of people go. But they also do the debuts that come do a reading, and it's like a 2-minute reading.
I love this.
And it's so nice. Like, I think as a debut, doing that reading, and Graham made the point at the last one that for many people, it would be the first time that they've ever read. It's kind of the best audience because the audience has been through that themselves and is so sympathetic, but it's also like that kind of, this is now an audience of my peers. It's such a lovely thing. Anyway, the readings, Graham did make the remark that he thought the readings this time were the best ever. I know, which I was like, oh, controversial, but then he appeared to be judging by their ability to stick within the time limit.
Hilariously, very Graham.
Yes, exactly. But Anna read, and like, among a lot of great readings, hers was really good.
Yeah. So Anna Kate Blair is this is her debut book. She's also works at Writers Victoria. She does programming there. And she has herself had a residency or fellowship of some description at MoMA in New York. Her degree and training is in, I believe, architecture and art.
What have I done with my life? Why did I not go to like the Iowa school?
We've got time. We've got time, Catherine. It's okay. So The Modern is the story of Sophia, who is a 29-year-old Australian who has got this fellowship at MoMA. As the book begins, she has just kind of got accidentally engaged to her longish term boyfriend, who is heading off to walk the Appalachian Trail for 5 months. So, I mean, funny setup, right? Anyway, yeah. I have feelings about the partner. I have feelings about the relationship right from the get-go.
Accidental engagement is not great news, is
it? No, not great news. And then not great news to go off and walk the Appalachian Trail for 5 months. You know, I have feelings about that kind of journey, and it's the same way I feel about men who golf and people who do long cycles on Sunday mornings, who generally out where I live are generally men of a certain age in their lycra, and I think like someone else is picking up the stuff for you doing what you're doing. Anyway, apologies to all the cyclists out there. I don't mean you particularly. Anyway,
you've got feelings. Audience.
I had feelings about these characters. Anna writes beautifully, and it's one of those beautiful combinations of ruminations on the nature of art. She's doing a particular study while she's there on both Frank O'Hara and another artist whose name I can't remember right at the moment, which is very telling. It's the woman's name that I can't remember, but I will. And so it's ruminations on the nature of art and her feelings about it, but also her feelings about marriage. And the artist that she's looking at is a woman who has painted and depicted weddings and brides in particular.
Did you look up the images?
I have not yet.
Yeah, I always do that, really.
That's very interesting. I'm adding that to my list of things to do because I will be in conversation with Anna on Monday the 2nd, the day that this episode airs. If you are in the Bayside area, we will be at Beaumaris Library at 6:30 p.m. It is a free event. I will, by that stage, after having prepped for the conversation, have looked at the pictures that the novel is about. The character of Sophia is both incredibly endearing and incredibly infuriating to read, which is, I'm sure, how Anna intended it. And I was torn as she is torn in the book about her feelings about marriage, about desire. She meets a woman who is kind of friend, pseudo love interest as well. It all gets very complicated, and it is a lot of her thinking about how she's feeling. I believe somewhere Anna has described the book in one of the events that she did as a book about overthinking, and it has that.
Oh, I love that.
It has that feeling the same as, in a way, Charlotte Stoneyard devotional is. It's this very internal rumination on life, how it is to be lived and how it has been lived thus far for the characters.
What an achievement to write books that so deeply grapple but are compulsive at the same time. Yes. I think that's so impressive.
Yes. And this question that the novel kind of opens with and that underlies the whole book for Sophia is that this quote from the artist that she's studying that says, you know, as she turns 30, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, has she fulfilled her promise? You know, has she reached the stage in life that one must as a 30-year-old, which feels, you know, very funny when you're already past that stage and thinking
it feels like, yeah,
fulfilled promises. But it very much kind of sticks to that brief. Is a very plain way of putting it, but the novel kind of twists and twists and twists and interrogates this idea of who this character is and how she should live her life. Very, very good. I'm excited to talk to Anna, particularly about the way that her own experiences have flavoured the way that this novel came out of her. So that is The Modern, Anna Kate Blair, and I'll be talking to her on Monday the 2nd at Beaumaris Library. You are having conversations too this week.
Yes. I'll just briefly mention a book that I think talks to Anna's quite well. It's called Really Good, Actually. It's by Monica Hasey, I think is how you say that. She's a US-based author. It's a debut book, and I think it was one of the recommendations that maybe Nick Bassine, who was a featured book earlier this year, recommended. Monica is an American author, and she's a screenwriter for Schitt's Creek, which I would put in my top three shows of all time. So that's a pretty appealing thing. It's about a woman who is 29 and after 2 years of marriage is getting divorced. So it is this kind of world unraveling, making bad decisions. It's definitely got a sad girl vibe, but I really liked it.
Okay, excellent. That I feel like that's a nice companion piece for The Modern. Very good.
Final one, I have to double endorse the Who Shat on the Floor at My Wedding. I listened and I absolutely loved it. I love when someone comes up with a concept that is like very very unique and also very transferable. And it's this idea of like a deep investigation into something that is pretty small, really. And I absolutely loved how they played it straight.
Oh, like, it is. We were literally talking about this at dinner last night. And one of the things that I said was, Catherine said I didn't even sell it well enough, that it was better than I explained it to be. And I said I thought that I was pretty hardcore about my selling of it. But we were
the detective is freaking hilarious.
Genius. Like,
she is so ridiculous and funny.
But one of the things that we were discussing was that one of my friends, Tess, thought it had the part that she really enjoyed was the feeling that you were in on an in-joke. You were watching an in-joke, which she described as having the same feeling listening to Annabelle Crabb and Lee Sales, that they're always on the brink of cracking up about something that you either know something about or you don't. The fact that whether or not they chanced upon or they just knew that characters like Hank were going to be such geniuses for the show, and the kind of accidental nature of it all.
Yeah, well, the periscope and stuff, like it just.
Oh my God, the periscope!
Like escalated. It was cool. And just even, I mean, those things that are just perfection of the lie detector test that they didn't want to spend too much. It's rated 2.5 stars.
It's a gift. It is a gift funny. So into it. We've got to mention some events. Grace Hardigan is the artist that Sophia is studying in the modern. I just wanted to say that because that has come into my head now. And considering we talked about wifedom, that seems very important to say.
Nearly wrote her out.
Exactly. I am doing an interesting event considering what I have been talking so much about when I've been talking about the hummingbird effect is AI and ChatGPT. And I'm doing an event for the ASA on AI. I'm kind of just really surprised and delighted I got the gig because it's with Tracy Spicer, who most recently wrote Man-Made, her incredible deep dive into the bias inherent in AI, and Holden Shepherd, who fabulous WA writer who has been campaigning really hard against the, you know, scraping and use of authors' work without their consent. So we are doing a conversation with Olivia Lancaster, who's the CEO of ASA, that looks at a whole bunch of these issues and the different thoughts that we are having. It is on Thursday, October the 26th. It's from 7:30 till 9 p.m. It's online. If you're an ASA member, there's a special price, but we'll put the links in the bio. I'm kind of those two, both Tracy and Holden, from my understanding, have very clear positions. I still feel like I'm in a world of floundering around in my learning about AI, but in particular I'm going to talk about how I've used it for creative purposes as well. So anyway, it promises to be a very interesting and informative session. So that is one I've got coming up. And I also wanted to mention, going to the country again, this time with Amy Lovett. So Amy Lovett, who wrote Mistakes and Other Lovers, and I are doing a little road trip to Meenian near Fish Creek. Have you been to Meenian?
I've been to Fish Creek, but I haven't been to Meenian.
Yeah. So Meenian, you possibly drove through it and didn't even notice. Formerly to me known as a place of, I think they do a garlic festival. It's also got a great bakery, other things, but it also now has an amazing bookshop. It's called Nice Stack of Books. And Amy and I are doing an event on October the 14th where we'll be talking about both Hummingbird and Mistakes and Other Lovers and probably a bazillion other things in between, because we'll have talked all the way down and we'll be talking all the way up. So it'll be like you catch us mid-conversation for this excellent bookstore, Nice Stack of Books. You've got one coming up.
I do. I've got an event with Claire Fletcher talking about her second novel, which we mentioned on the podcast, I think, last time we caught up. It's called Love Match. It's a rural romance set in the same world as her first book, Five Bush Weddings. That event is at Glen Waverley Robinson's Bookshop on Friday, the 6th of October.
Amazing.
So the same week that this episode comes out.
I want to mention one more thing that I completely forgot that kind of doesn't fit in any section, maybe listening, maybe a homework task for our listeners who are writers. The most extraordinary thing that I witnessed at the Ride Around the Murray Festival, which was chef's kiss, was the Saturday night event, which is called Stereo Stories. Have you heard about Stereo Stories?
Oh, is this where they blow out a song and they get someone to talk through the
Different thing. That amazing podcast. This is a different thing. This is a band. I feel almost torn talking about it because I get the feeling that this is Right Around the Murray's, you know, little secret, but I need to share this because other writers knew about it. So Stereo Stories is a band of extraordinary musicians. And what they do is they did like a 2-hour set in which one of the men from the band starts off with a story, a spoken word story about a particular moment, either specifically about a song or where there is a key kind of song that could be a soundtrack. And then the band jump in at different points and kind of play to this spoken word. It is so well done. Are they exquisite musicians, exquisite storytellers, all of them. And then what they do for Ride Around the Murray is they invite some of the guest writers to speak and have this whole process done for them. So the artists that spoke or the writers that spoke were the extraordinary Deborah Dank, who I heard speak a couple of times First Nations woman who wrote We Come With This Place that just blitzed and took out all the awards this year. She spoke extraordinarily. She read from the book, but also the band played Slim Dusty kind of behind her stories. It was just magnificent. Paul Delgano did a great, great piece. Irma Gold did Madonna, which was fantastic. And Rin Collins, who we featured her debut when we were doing all the debut crew, or the first half of the debut crew a couple of months back. Her debut is called Fed to Red Birds. And she did the most extraordinary piece that had Icelandic rock, Icelandic metal maybe behind it. And one of the singers from this band, who was the kind of singer who you just immediately crush on, she had learnt this song in Icelandic for the gig. Anyway, long story to tell you, it was absolutely brilliant, such an incredible show. But writers can submit to Stereo Stories to do one of these. So if you go to stereostories.com, you'll find a whole lot of information about them, and you can write your own story in the hope that you'll get picked up an event with them. So just hats off to Right Around the Murray the incredible Stereo Stories. Very, very, very cool. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.